What if a skeptical professor at a secular university announced in your class, "After doing a lot of research, I have come to the amazing conclusion that Jesus died on the cross, was buried in a tomb that was found empty on the third day, after which he appeared to 500 of his followers who saw him in bodily form." As shocking as this may be, you should be aware that there's an academic revolution taking place about Jesus among many of the most respected religious scholars in the world in some of our most prestigious academic institutions. Today on the John Ankerberg Show, you will hear the historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection that even skeptics believe. My guest is Dr. Gary Habermas, the world's leading expert on the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He is chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Liberty University and has authored, co-authored, or edited 39 books and written well over 100 articles and reviews for scholarly journals and other publications. Since 1975, he has been tracking 4,000 of the most influential scholars in the world in English, French, and German, and discovered that 90% of them believe 12 historical facts about Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection are true. Yet many of the scholars who claim these facts about Jesus are historically true are still atheists. How can that be? Today, you will find out on this edition of The John Ankerberg Show. Welcome to our program. I'm John Ankerberg. Thanks for joining me. As you've heard, my guest today is Dr. Gary Habermas. He's the chairman of the philosophy department at Liberty University. And our topic is the resurrection argument that changed the generation of scholars. We're talking about, did Jesus actually rise from the dead? What does the academic world say about the facts of Jesus' resurrection? Things, folks, have changed. There's a revolution in the last 30, 40 years in the academic world at the highest levels. And Gary knows about it. He's talking about it. And he's talking about the historical facts about Jesus' resurrection that the guys at the top level and at some of the greatest schools, people that call themselves atheist skeptics, will say these historical facts are true. So I want you not to move. I want you to listen to this argument. He calls it the minimal facts argument. Okay? Some of you might be saying, well, listen, John, are you going to talk about this from the Bible? Yeah, because the scholars will use the Bible. They're not saying it's inspired or inerrant. Gary, how would they use the information we're going to talk about today?
They prefer you to use the material from Paul. They'll secondarily use the Gospels, but they want to stay in Paul if they can, because they say, unlike so many of the other books, some of them will say Paul's the only New Testament author we know for sure. So 13 books with his name on it. Well, he wrote at least 7 of those. So they feel like in Paul, they are getting as close back to the sources as they can. Plus, he came from the other side. He was converted. Therefore, he, when you're converted like that and it's a life change, you're bringing some things to the table that make you a valuable witness. They could tell by just the way the guy talks, he's not interested in misleading or lying or whatever else. He might be wrong, but he's not going to be some kind of ogre out to steal your soul. So they like Paul for a lot of reasons, and yeah, they think he's really intelligent. He can put a good argument together.
Another way of saying it, he's the darling of the skeptics.
He is.
He's an intellectual, and they believe he's giving them straight historical information, and they actually accept 7 of these books, all of them, same books, and they say, use these books, he's giving you good information. Now, you have developed a timeline of some of the things that they accept. And I want you to give the people that, you know, are joining us for the very first time this week, we're only using 2 passages, basically, 1 Corinthians 15, we're using Galatians chapter 1 and Galatians chapter 2, which were all just one. There was no division. It was all continuous text. And the fact is that I would like for you to present to them how we get to 1 Corinthians 15, how far it was from the cross when Jesus was crucified and the resurrection, how we get to the events he's talking about there, and then how we bring the events, how the scholars in the world will accept bringing back the information that Jesus appeared to
to 12, to over 500 people at one time, to James, to Paul himself, going right straight back to the events, you know, Paul 2 years from the cross, and Peter and James right after the resurrection, okay? How did skeptics accept this data? Give us your timeline.
Well, if we start again with the crucifixion, what we said was Paul comes on the scene at about plus two or three. 3 years later, he goes to Jerusalem. But in the meantime, a few years later, he was already preaching the gospel, and he settles down to write 1 Corinthians, 53, 55 AD, somewhere, if you're going to put the cross at 33, for example, somewhere between 18 and 25 years. I mean, and again, I emphasized how many of us are sure of things that happened in our life at more than 25 years. I mean, this is a good close. We're not asking somebody to talk about Alexander plus 400 years. We're down to this. But Paul wrote it here. He writes, he was there with them just 4 years earlier, but he went to Jerusalem at about plus five, plus six. Now, oftentimes critics stop here and they go, hey, the material's within 5 years, good enough for me. But I'm thinking, don't stop there. I know you're prone to stop there. I want to say to them, I know you're prone to stop there because Paul's your darling and you got the material from him, a plus five. But we can beat plus five. If early is good, and early is one of my minimal facts, he was proclaimed very early. You know, people will say to me, they'll criticize this and they'll say, come on, eyewitnesses can be wrong. And even early sources can be wrong. And I'll say, okay, let's think about what you're saying. There's a reason our law courts are based on early and eyewitness testimony. I know they can be wrong, but because early eyewitnesses can be wrong, what do you want? Do you want late non-eyewitnesses? Maybe they're better, right? Maybe Plutarch's better on Alexander plus 400. Come on, early eyewitnesses is the best you're going to get. So if the best is what we have, don't complain.
Yeah, you know. What you're saying is the sources about what Alexander said and did are 400 years after he lived, okay?
Actually up to 450. So
yeah, and some historians have no problem with that. There's a 400-year gap between the time the guy died and the fact is when they're writing about him, and you're saying, you know, didn't something creep in during the 400 years? But if you're accepting that, you shouldn't have a problem with Paul here at, you know, 25, and we're getting back down here to 5 years after the events?
Right.
Wow.
And they'll say, yeah, but you're reporting miracles. Miracles are in all the Greco-Roman histories. And then they'll say, well, but that's the point. They're histories. And you'll say, well, do you know what the latest material since about 1990? Richard Burridge, his doctoral dissertation, a classic scholar at University of London, does a dissertation where he does comparison of Greco-Roman biographies to the Gospels. And right now, the fact that the Gospels are Greco-Roman biography is the leading conclusion. So they're the same genre. Yeah, but that's still Christian, and they're still, oh, wait a minute. So the Romans didn't have a religion, right? So when Suetonius writes his 12 Caesars, and in the table of contents, a half of them, it says, later deified. No religion there. That's just straight history. I mean, we all have religious thoughts, and it's ingrained in us. And they go, well, you still have miracles. I say, well, hey, have you heard about any of the reports today of investigative reporters about some miracle claims today? Maybe we're wrong for not putting histories in our account. And according to Craig Keener, in the Western world, the Western intellectuals are about the only ones who don't work miracles in. The rest of the world, he calls it the greater world, does work miracles in. So maybe the New Testament's right.
Yeah, and we're also going to do a series, folks, on near-death experiences. One of the other little studies that Gary's been doing for about 30 years is he's been tracking near-death experiences and finding out if there's information, and there's books. We're going to do a whole series on that, but just throw that into this fact,
right,
of near-death experiences in terms of some things that we can't explain are happening, and they're documenting,
right,
it.
Well, it's an extremely important point, because they could still say what sticks in my craw is that you're giving these reports, but you're asking me to believe in the Land of Oz. And I'll say, do you know what? According to the latest book on near-death experiences from the University of Missouri Press, written mostly by medical doctors, between 9 and 20 million Americans have had near-death experiences. So, between 9 and 20 million Americans have maybe visited Narnia? I mean, maybe you shouldn't be so close to Oz or Narnia. So don't shut me down because of that. People are there. So that's the world we live in.
All right, so 5 years after the cross.
Okay, now here's the cross. Just a reminder, here's the cross. Here's plus 5 or plus 6. How do we get earlier? All right, Paul comes. He talks to Peter. He talks to James. He's hearing it from them, maybe for the first time outside of hearsay. Maybe he's hearing for the first time what these disciples, what these apostles did when Jesus first appeared to them after Black Saturday, and they were able to, imagine the glee. Imagine the, whoa, my world's not lost. I don't have to go back to fishing and tax collecting. Everything's there. Well, tell me about it, guys. Okay, that's the key. Paul's listening. They're talking. If Paul hears their testimony, it's safe to say Peter and James knew their own testimony before Paul knew it. Paul hears it. They had it. The facts on which it's based are even earlier than their memories of the facts. Boom. That's why everybody says we're back to the events. Paul hears it. They said it. The facts on which they're based are earlier.
They saw it.
You stop right here. That's it.
Yeah. So, okay.
That's why James D.G. Dunn says we're months from the cross. That's why Hurtado says days. That's why Bart Ehrman, to go to the skeptical side, that's why Bart Ehrman says, I have no problem saying the early disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus. He said, why wouldn't I affirm that? It's a fact of history. Bart Ehrman says it, and E.P. Sanders, as you mentioned, calls himself a liberal, retired from Duke, used to be at Oxford, and Sanders says, when he gives his list of accepted facts, sort of like the ones we start these programs with, when he gives a list of his accepted facts, one of Sanders' accepted facts is the disciples saw Jesus after his death. And he adds, every time he says it, he goes, what he looked like, I can't exactly tell you, but they saw him. What I mean is he doesn't just say they thought they saw him. That they saw him is in Sanders' list of accepted facts. That's how far critical scholarship has come. I'll tell you, when I was in grad school and Rudolf Bultmann was king, you would never have heard language like that. We're too close.
All right. This information that Paul actually preached and then wrote in 1 Corinthians 15, that first little section there, is what scholars call a creed.
Correct.
Okay? And that creed, Paul says, I got from somebody else. And the question is, who did he get it from? He could have gotten it from Peter and James at 5 years after the cross when he met with them in Jerusalem, or that creed could have come when he actually saw the risen Jesus at plus 2 from the cross. All right? And scholars want to know, when did this creed, this information, which, what is that information, by the way, that's in 1 Corinthians 15, and then tell us about how far back the scholars are saying this goes?
Well, we used in an earlier show, we used the words pre-Pauline. Here's the cross. Paul comes to Jesus. Now, pre-Pauline could be, in this case, anything up to the writing of 1 Corinthians, but technically, the real heavy pre-Pauline stuff is right in here. It is this. When Paul comes to Jesus, if he would have stopped and said, stop the presses, I'm a Christian now. What do we already know about Jesus? That creed would have been there. That creed would have been in existence. That's pre-Pauline means Christ died for sins according to Scriptures, buried, rose again from the dead according to Scriptures, and appeared to Cephas and then two individuals, three groups. Paul appends his name. Except for Paul appending his name, that list is there when Paul's converted.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
But I love the fact he appeared to 500 people at one time, all right?
Yeah.
And he appeared to the apostles, and two things. We want to talk about his meeting with Peter and James, but he meets with all of the apostles at 48. But sticking with this this pre-Pauline thing is this answers the question, Christianity was not invented by Paul.
Exactly, and that's so important because it was a 19th century German liberal view, which still there's a hangover of today, and the argument goes like this. Nobody wants to blame Jesus. Jesus was a first century itinerant prophet, a really good guy, do-gooder, probably back on the farm, but he would go out and preach and just try to lead the good life and seek ye first the kingdom of God and the Sermon on the Mountain. That's Jesus. Paul is the cult leader who comes out and sings a new song, and now he's one of the Greco-Roman dying and rising gods who, and they want to blame it on Paul. How can Paul be the maestro that strums the song for Christianity? When Paul comes to the Lord, this text is already in existence. And we already have, not just this one, the text we have, the early creeds, they call Jesus Lord. And then, I mean, it's in a context where he's on the right hand of God. I mean, it's in a context where Messiah, Son of God, and Lord is there at the beginning, and it's pre-Pauline. Yeah, Paul's not the inventor of this. Now, as far as what the creeds are, here's the easiest way for me to think of it. Besides the earlier dot, 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 dot for people who couldn't write their name, another way to think of it is this. Let's say the cross is 30 AD. Let's say the earliest New Testament book is 1 Thessalonians at 50 AD. Some people put it 48, 49, and some people put the cross at 33. So like Paul Barnett, who puts it at 33, the historian, as Paul Barnett says, if that's 33 and the book's 48, that's only 15 years.
Right.
But let's go with late dating, okay? The cross is 30 and 1 Thessalonians is 50. Nice round 20. Now here's the question. In 1 Thessalonians, Jesus is the Son of God. He is Lord, the two loftiest titles, unless you count the half dozen times he's called God in the New Testament. But Lord, a lot of people think Lord is the loftiest title. It's the translation Kyrios. Kyrios was the translation of the Hebrew Jehovah or Yahweh. So it's already there in 1 Thessalonians. Now here's the million-dollar question. If 30 AD Jesus dies, if 20 years later they're calling him Son of God and Lord, what change took place during those 20 years? Is that when all this mythology grew up and he was? No. Why not? Because the early creeds, there are a number of pre-Pauline creeds out of the gate. I use that phrase out of the gate to mean when Christianity started and the preaching started going, what was the earliest preaching like? And Richard Baucom he got it from somebody else actually, but Richard Baucom's line is just amazing.
And who is Richard Baucom?
Richard Baucom, Cambridge, used to be at St. Andrew's University, retired now, one of the top New Testament scholars in the world. And Richard Baucom says, the earliest Christology is the highest Christology. The old view is that, to use our chart from earlier, the old view is it took the church 65 years to the Gospel of John to unpack John 1:1-18, the prologue that starts out, the Word was God, and he calls him again. He's called God in John 1:18. Oh, it took 65 years to realize he was God. Now, Richard Buckham told me himself, he said, and Jimmy Dunn told me this himself, they both said, that used to be my view. It took 65 years, not for them to make the story up. Jesus' preaching was so heavy, it took them 65 years to unpack what he was saying, and finally someone said, he's got to be God to say that. Okay, Buckham says, yes, except for one thing. Didn't take to hear. It's true back here. And Larry Hurtado's in on this too.
Yeah.
Hurtado, Dunn, and Baucom. They say the earliest Christology was the highest. How do you know? Well, one of the keys is the pre-Pauline creeds.
Yeah, Larry Hurtado was retired head of the religion department at Edinburgh University, and he says, coming out of the gates, what? There were two doctrines.
Coming out of the gates, he says, the two doctrines were the deity of Christ and the resurrection. Of course, if there's a resurrection, there's got to be a death. So that's just another way of saying we've got the gospel, deity, death, resurrection.
And Hurtado says, coming out of the gates, there would be no Christianity unless these two doctrines were there coming out of the gates. So, you know, we're talking just a few months after Jesus' resurrection. You got all these eyewitnesses. Stuff is happening in Jerusalem, but they're saying, this da-da-da-da-da, the creeds are being memorized by people. The teachings of Jesus are putting into a form that they can do. We're going to do a whole program on what the creeds actually say, because these little creeds are scattered throughout the New Testament, and the scholars have identified them. The best way I can say they have identified them is like, if you guys are writing a term paper, you remember quoting from the Encyclopedia Britannica and trying to work that in like your own words? You're reading your words, and
your
all of a sudden you get
is off,
and you say, wow, this doesn't sound like me at all. Yeah. So you got to put it in quotes, all right? Otherwise, they would understand it. Well, in the Greek, you can see Paul's writing, and all of a sudden he comes to this language he doesn't even use, and it's a creedal statement.
Plus he says, I gave you what I was given.
Right.
In English, we'd say, Bob says, end note.
Yeah.
We'd use an end note.
Okay, so the fact is now we've got skeptics. Even Bar Ehrman will take it back this far, and he's an atheist. And I got a question for you. And the question is, you've got skeptics and atheists that claim that, and they're head of these departments of New Testament in different universities around the world, saying, coming out of the gates, you have the deity of Christ and you have the resurrection appearances. We believe that the risen Jesus actually appeared to all these people that are in the creeds, and they'll say it's a historical fact. These are all historical facts. You call them the minimal historical facts that they all accept. We're talking 95% of the guys at the top of the pile across the world. You've documented 2,000 of them, and you only put the 2,000 because you got 4,000 others that you could have put in there, but you're saying, I'm taking the most influential scholars, and you're saying, they're saying this. They agree with what you have just said.
They agree, that's what Paul said.
Now, I've got a question for you, and this is also for you in the audience. If we have this evidence that Jesus actually did come forth from the grave on the third day, and the fact is he appeared to all of these people we've been talking about, and the scholars say the evidence is there, the historical evidence is there. Bart Ehrman says, why wouldn't I believe it? It's a historical fact. So, you know, it is. But he's an atheist, all right? How in the world can you say, I believe these facts, but you don't say, I do to Jesus? You don't become a Christian. How do you do that, Gary?
I think the short story is, if we were best friends and I was happily married and I wanted you to be happily married because I think that's the way life should be. And I say, hey, listen, like to introduce you to somebody. Call it a blind date, call it whatever you want. Like to introduce you to somebody. I think you're really going to enjoy this. And you go, oh, come on. It's only because you're best friend I'm going to do this. So you go on a date, you come back. I go, what do you think? Oh, she was wonderful. Yeah, everything you said. I go, hey, can I be your best man? You go, whoa. Look, not only is it just the first date, you're assuming that perfect case equals wedding. Here's my message. Perfect case equals good time. I'm not ready to be married. I maybe never get married. And I think that's what a lot of them are saying. I'm not ready to say I do to Jesus. I'm not ready. It's interesting in Scripture, we're called the bride. He's the groom. It's a marriage scenario. I'm not ready to say I do, but I do want to keep learning. I'd like to keep meeting this person. Who knows? But right now, no, I'm not going to say I do. I think for a lot of them, these are data. And my PhD might be a New Testament, might be theology. I'm just studying what I'm told to study.
Okay. You know. Let me go. You one day said, I do. For the person that says, I've heard enough, I want to put my faith and trust in Jesus. I want to say I do to him. What were the words that you kind of used? What would you suggest they say to Jesus right
well,
now?
I think a person could be in Christ without saying any words. But I think if I were the person who were doing the dating, to use my illustration, I'd like the wedding ceremony because I want to think back and say, better or worse, rich or poor, till death do we part. I remember those. I might want to frame a marriage certificate. So I might want to remember that date. So I would say the person should be making a commitment to Jesus, not a, yeah, I believe you, like I believe who the president is. I believe George Washington, the first president of the United States. We're saying, I do. Hook, line, and sinker, like the men got out of the boat and left their nets, and like Levi Matthew left the tax collecting station. The question is, are we willing to make an I do type commitment to Jesus? I think that's the key.
I'll follow you.
In light of the deity, death, resurrection. Don't forget, faith is not in historical facts. Nobody loves historical facts more than I do, but faith doesn't go in history. Faith goes in the person about whom the history is true.
Yeah, and folks, I'll tell you this, is that when you say I do to Jesus and invite him to come into your life and say I want to follow you forever, don't be afraid of that, because when he comes in, he gives you power that you didn't have before. He starts to change your life. He does something to you that has not happened before. You become a believer in him, a follower of him, and he's the one that is supplying the power for you to live the Christian life. And if you haven't done that, why not just take this moment and say, Lord, I say I do to you. Show me the next steps. All right, next week, we've been talking about five facts. I'm going to show you a clip of a debate that Gary and I did with a man who was the number one philosophical atheist in the world for 40 years. Okay, his name was Dr. Anthony Flew. We had a debate with him, and I'm going to show you 2 minutes of that debate next week. And Gary didn't present just five historical facts to Dr. Anthony Flew, to the world's leading foremost expert on atheism, okay, a Hume scholar, all right? He presented 12, and I'm going to let you hear the 12 facts that that Gary presented to Anthony Flew, and I want you to hear how Anthony Flew accepted all 12 of the facts that he presented. We'll talk about that next week. I hope you'll join us.
For additional resources, log on to jashow.org. That's jashow.org.